everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sail, and today we'll be taking a topical stroll through the non-fiction shelves. Political journalist Ejje Tamilkaran confronts rising populism in How to Lose a Country, The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship.
Truth is interesting. It's just you have to remove all the other nasty, so-called entertaining lies.
Bank of England advisor Jonathan Haskell introduces us to the dark matter of investment in capitalism without capital.
It's very difficult to measure the value of software and the value of goodwill and the value of design and all those very intangible things.
And Trina Beckett uncovers the fascinating lives of the wives of the generals in Deadlier Than the Mail.
High-ranking officers and the government officials would actually turn to her rather than her husband's authority because she was the one that knew it all.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Ejje Tamilkaran is one of Europe's leading political thinkers. Her latest book, How to Lose a Country, The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship, is an impassioned call to combat the spread of nationalism. She identifies a common pattern in the rise of populist movements to power and urges us to act before it happens here. Ejje Tamilkaran, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You take as a starting point for the book the attempted coup in Istanbul on the 15th of July 2016. And you identify that this was a staged act by President Erdogan and the culmination of a recognisable pattern for how populist movements grab power. And you've written the book as a warning to the rest of us.
Well, we are not sure still it's a stage act or not, but it's certainly true that Mr. Erdogan has turned this crisis into a giant opportunity for him, a political opportunity. And since then, I think nobody would deny this. Things have been going down the hill, obviously, for, you know, half of the country, at least. And I wrote the book not for Turkish people, but I wrote it for European people in European countries and United States, because there is striking similarities between what this country or European countries are going through at the moment and what Turkey has been through since last 15 years. And I thought this is an opportunity to make a warning call, sort of, if I may say that, call people for a global conversation about what we can do about this.
And the steps that you identify, well, you give us a roadmap, really, for how to identify how a rather extreme and quite often buffoonish politician can go from somebody on the fringes of the political debate to, well, dare I say it, being president of a world superpower.
Exactly. There are seven stages or common patterns, so to speak, that is present in almost all the examples countries that have been subjected to rising right-wing populism. And I think people need to see through the political confusion and this moral mess, and they should find out the main mechanism, the fundamental logic that runs this perpetual machine of violence, hostility, and polarization. Therefore, I came up with these seven steps, and the book is, in fact, ironically written as a manual to a dictator. It's like, you know, how can you build a dictatorship in seven easy steps? But I am pretty sure the readers will get the message in this irony. These are also the seven steps that they shouldn't be missing when they are happening, because it's quite easy to miss them. And we missed recognizing some of them in Turkey during the last 15 years. The first one is create a movement because party is over. and it talks about the general loss of faith in representative democracy and all the institutions that constitute a representative democracy, and how the word movement can be mesmerizing for people who feel that they need a change. Political and moral change. So the, you know, magical word is always a movement. How you create that movement, how it is energized and mobilized and so on and so forth, it's, you know, it's a long story and it's in the book. And the second step, which is quite relevant right now in Britain, is disrupt rationale and terrorize the language. And I try to come up with the main outlines of right-wing populist narrative and how they get into a discussion, how they dismantle the entire discussion, and finally, by terrorizing all the other people in the conversation, they come up as the only surviving speaking voice. So I think readers can find, especially in this chapter, Disrupt Rationale and Terrorize Language, how they shouldn't be talking to a right-wing populist, how they shouldn't be dealing with a right-wing populist, because we in Turkey lost a lot of time trying to understand how we can find a common ground with this political movement, how we can make them part of the political discussion and so on and so forth, which is a very vital discussion in Britain now, I know, and also in the United States. It has been so, at least. And I think there's a lot about that in the second chapter of How to Lose a Country.
Engaging these people in conversation, you're just on a losing streak. You take an imaginary conversation between Aristotle and a populist leader and show how Aristotle is, well, constantly wrong-footed by being subject to a personal attack rather than actually a debate of ideas. And I suppose you point out that if your populist leader turns round and calls everybody else around him a fascist, then he can't possibly be a fascist because he's identified everybody else as what he isn't. And it shows how debate has been turned on its head.
Exactly. We all use certain consensuses to communicate with each other. We don't even name them. We just know them. This is basic human reasoning. And I think the populist narrative and the schizophrenic rationality they use is dismantling this basic human reasoning. And that's why people in most of the countries feel paralyzed when they are talking to populists, because they cannot operate in that schizophrenic logic and they cannot apply their, you know, normal basic reasoning to the ongoing conversation. That is why it becomes almost impossible to talk to right-wing populists. And I wanted to prove, in fact, that this is impossible in a way, to deal with that narrative with our conventional communication tools is, well, let's say, almost impossible. And I do think that here again, we have to see through the confusion and picture or get the outline of the logic of what's going on.
You call it the infantilization of political argument and the infantilization of language. Now, those of us who are parents have learnt that we can't argue with our toddlers. We put them on the naughty step. Mm-hmm. How do we put a populist leader on the naughty step?
Well, you want me to give a spoiler about the book?
Only a little one.
I think one thing we can do is reveal the missing part of the logic in the conversation and to reveal that he's doing something to dismantle and terrorize the conversation. So one important thing is don't get engaged with him or her in the same narrative, because there's another aspect of right-wing populism narrative which is really poisonous, is that it diminishes you, it pushes you into this dichotomy and you cannot get out of it, and then you find yourself trying to defend your ideas rather than putting out arguments or having a real discussion with the populist.
I was talking to an author recently who pointed out that in her novel that the reason lies spread quickly is because quite often they're more interesting than the truth. And you point out how leaders as diverse as Hugo Chavez in Venezuela or Erdogan or Trump have rewritten history, have denied some of our accepted truths and created post-truth. It's fundamental human nature to chase after an interesting story. How do we make the narrative of what has become accepted truth and therefore a little bit boring more interesting?
Truth is already interesting. The problem is people are too much addicted to entertainment and too much addicted to fun. Therefore, knowing the joy of knowing the truth is somehow not enough for them anymore. And I think we have to change this first. And this is a moral issue. And in the third chapter about the shame, I try to do that, you know, connect the post-truth concept with the shamelessness and the lack of morality in politics that has been going on, especially since the last decades. So truth is interesting. It's just you have to remove all the other nasty so-called entertaining lies. That's it. That's what you're supposed to do. And also, we have to be careful about this freedom of speech argument, because it always comes up with the populists. And I told a little bit about that in the book as well.
Yes, I mean, I'm acting slightly devil's advocate because you use truthful stories, very personal stories in some cases, to demonstrate that rational thinking still very much has a place in today's debate.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, like, one of the things, it's great that you're devil's advocate at the moment, because this is one of the, as a matter of fact, reflexes that the book creates. Whoever reads the book, they want to ask me this question, how about that? How about this? And this is good because I wrote this book to create that conversation. Yes, how about the other thing? How about this question? Let's talk about it. What do you think? What's your experience? And what do you think we should do? And so on. So this is exactly what I want. Yes, let's be each other's devil's advocate and let's get a real way to get rid of this malady of our times.
You use a very, very telling phrase in the book that the banality of evil, such as we saw with the little grey men who were behind the Holocaust, has actually become the evil of banality, that people don't enter into debate anymore, that we are maybe just too nice to call out the bullying populists anymore.
Yeah, banality of evil. I think we really have to go back to the 80s to talk about this. And I am very sad to say it is time to reverse Hannah Arendt's, you know, banality of evil to evil of banality, because we are witnessing and being subjected to a different kind of evil, which doesn't look like a frowning man with a uniform. It looks like a casual man with jeans and who is actually laughing. When evil of banality comes in that outfit, it's not easy to recognize it. When it comes with the argument of freedom of speech or real democracy or real people, it's not easy to diagnose it and it's not easy to respond to it before it is too late.
And there are a couple of really surprising things that come out of the book, that actually laughter can be a false friend in political debate, in our engaging with politics.
Yeah, laughter, well, I mean, like, what kind of laughter? It depends on that, because laughter has been a joyous response to oppression during Cairo, during Tahrir, during Gezi uprising and so on. But then it changed. And I think countries who are now witnessing right-wing populism should be very careful about how they laugh, when they laugh, and why they laugh. Because that laughter goes through a transformation as the right-wing populism takes over power. And in the beginning, it feels like as long as we can laugh about it, it's not serious, it won't hurt us. But then that laughter turns into a sarcastic, poisonous, complacent response to life in general.
And it was just such a complacent response to you speaking at a book event in Britain that actually gave rise to this book, wasn't it?
Yeah, one of the reasons, yes. Western countries love to romanticize people like me by calling them exile and, you know, giving them the role of victim who ran away from an underdeveloped country to the arms of Europe and so on and so forth. And some people who are reading my books might feel that I am the victim, but I reject that word, the victim and the exile, and I don't want to be that person. So yeah, one of the events for book events for Turkey, The Insane of Melancholy, my previous book, was like that. I spoke about what's happening in Turkey and so on, and one woman asked me, so what can we do for you? And I said, well, what can I do for you? And I wrote this book.
Well, it certainly had me listening to the news programs with more open ears and asking more questions. And what was delightful for me was that you actually read the audiobook version yourself. Was that something that you felt very strongly about doing?
Well, I didn't want to do it, in fact, because I'm not native in this language, and also I have horrible pronunciation mistakes, which I did right now. And also, I'm not a good loud reader, I thought. But my publisher and my dear editor, Helen Garden-Williams, she said it would be really nice because it's my voice in the book and people should hear my voice, which is somewhere between merry and faithful and I don't know what. So it was like that film, Pygmalion, My Fair Lady. It was 5 full days of young guys getting really, really older sound engineers because they were correcting my pronunciation mistakes. So, yeah, there's a lot of blood and sweat and tears in that audiobook.
Easier to write than to read.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but it was not easy, let's put it that way.
I believe that you have connections with blind people and blind charities back in Turkey.
Like many other people, many other writers, it's so important to me to be able to reach them. And I know how they are working hard to reach the written texts and so on. And one time in Bosphorus University, I went to a blind center and they showed me how they listened to my columns in audio in Turkey. And I couldn't understand a word because it was so fast and it didn't sound like anything to me, but they were able to understand it. So I thought, my God, develop another ability in order to read my work. And my mother, a few years back, as a birthday present, she turned one of my books into Braille alphabet and she put it in the blind library. So, yeah, and I did audiobooks in Turkish for blind libraries as well. So I am so looking forward to, in fact, for this audiobook to reach the blind community.
Well, thanks to our relationship with HarperCollins, it's gone straight into the RNIB Talking Books Library. And I hope that a lot of our listeners will, like me, thoroughly enjoy listening to it and then listening and watching the news with opened eyes and ears. Ece Temelkaran, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On. And I look forward to meeting you again in the future.
Thank you so very much. Thanks a lot. In no time, the TV screens are showing the young, terrified soldiers being beaten and strangled to death by this mob. And that is when the never-ending Selah from all the minarets in the country begins. Selah is a special prayer recited after death. It has such a shivering tone that even those who are not familiar with Muslim customs can tell that it is about the irreversible, the end. Tonight, Selah is followed by loud announcements from minarets calling people to the streets in the name of God to save the president, the democracy, the nation. The tune of death now shares the sky with jets. The delirious Allahu Akbars of Erdogan supporters and the soldiers' cries for help. And I remember the poem that started everything. The minarets are our bayonets. The domes are helmets. The mosques are barracks, and the faithful are soldiers. It was Erdogan who recited the poem at a public event in 1999, leading to him being imprisoned for 4 months for inciting religious hatred, and transforming him first into a martyr for democracy, then a ruthless leader.
Thanks to HarperCollins, How to Lose a Country, The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship, written and narrated by Eji Tamulkaran, is available as TB703956. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Trina Beckett will introduce us to some of the women beside the greatest generals in British history. But first, my next guest is one of the team that sets the UK's interest rates. Jonathan Haskell is a Professor of Economics and a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. He was appointed last year because of his expertise in measuring the contribution that intangible assets make to economic growth, a subject he and co-author Stian Westlake explore in their book Capitalism Without Capital. He joined me in the studio to explain more. Jonathan Haskell, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much, Red. Absolute pleasure to be here.
You begin the book by defining exactly what an intangible asset is, and you start with the example of the privatisation of Stansted Airport.
We do, Red. I mean, that was a very big commercial decision made by the government, and in many ways it exemplified a kind of old economy example whereby the value of Stansted Airport is a very tangible thing. If you think about Stansted Airport's assets and the value underneath it, it's the runways and the buildings and the fuel pumps and all and the trucks which run around the airport all the time, you know, carrying your baggage. It's a very tangible kind of asset. And it was something, therefore, that the valuers at the time, who were trying to determine the best deal, for the parties involved, it was something that the valuers of the time could really get their arms around. And in a sense, what our book tries to do is it takes that as a starting point and it looks at how the economy has changed to a world in which assets are much more intangible and much harder to value.
And you point out that actually in many ways Stansted was being valued in the same way as it was valued by the Doomsday Book back in the 11th century, but that the accountants and lawyers who were counting up the assets had to take into account things that didn't exist then, like IT and know-how and goodwill, which they find notoriously difficult to quantify.
Yeah, that's right. We looked there on electronic records at the Doomsday Book, and my co-author, who is a medieval historian by background, a kind of lapsed medieval historian, I should say, was very keen on these historical type of parallels. And indeed, it's rather wonderful. If you look at the Doomsday Book records for the area around Stansted Airport, you find, you know, evaluation of the farms, evaluation of the buildings, evaluation of the cattle, all of which, of course, was done for reasons of raising taxes and so forth back then. And if you look at the modern day valuations, they include the buildings, as we've just mentioned. But as you've just said, Red, they also include these slightly harder to value things, such as the IT equipment and the goodwill. And the book kind of concentrates more on those harder to value aspects.
Now, that's been your area of research. That's certainly why you've been brought in to the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, because you see that measuring the impact of investment in these intangible assets is something that is vital to economic growth in the 21st century.
That's right. Since September, I've had the privilege of being on the Monetary Policy Committee, and, you know, as your listeners will know, both in the UK and other rate-setting committees throughout the world, we spend an enormous amount of time kind of crawling over the economic data. And one thing that the investment data should give you a handle on is the future prospects for the economy, because the investment data, we think, and most central banks think, is a terrific potential signal to how people are expecting the economy to evolve, and they're having to put their money, you know, where their expectations are. So central banks throughout the world look very closely at the investment data. And then there are two interesting things with the intangible investment data, if I could just say very quickly. I mean, one is it just isn't measured very well. It's either not measured at all, because it's very difficult to measure the value of software and the value of goodwill and the value of design and all those very intangible things. So either it's not measured at all, number one. And number two is it's got very important economic properties which make the economy behave rather differently. And so if we miss it out by not counting it, and then we miss it out by not, you know, thinking through its economic properties, we might be getting a misleading picture of how we think the economy is going to evolve.
Yes, and you call it the dark matter of investment, which equates it with the stuff that we don't know about physics, I suppose.
Yes, I also have the honour to work at Imperial College, and that's stuff full of scientists who do all this complicated stuff on 95% of the universe that we don't understand, namely the dark matter part of it. So we tried to give it a little bit of a scientific kind of air to it, just to add a little bit of credibility for my colleagues.
And you argue that because of underinvestment in intangible assets, that has actually led to a slowdown in economic growth and also productivity in the UK and further afield.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe it might help if I just talk through a little example. So if you think of one of the key intangible assets, let's think of, say, the design of the iPhone. If you think back to what phones were like before the iPhone came along, they all, you know, looked and felt all a bit funny. They had funny keyboards and funny aerials sticking out of them and, you know, weird flippy bits that flipped back and forth that the children broke off and, you know, all that kind of thing. Once the iPhone came out, essentially within about 18 months, every single smartphone looked and felt like an iPhone, that sheer kind of feel and the touchscreen and so forth with which you'll be familiar. So that's an example of an intangible asset, namely a design, a kind of an idea like a design. And the crucial point about that is that once Apple had had that idea, other people were able to take advantage of that idea. So the time and the effort and the money that Apple put into generating that intangible asset, namely the idea, in the language of economics, spilled over to various other firms. So where I'm getting to your question is, if we reach hard economic times and companies like Apple stop investing so much in design, then that slows down productivity for Apple. But, and here's the crucial bit, it also slows down productivity and the opportunities for other people, because they're denied the opportunity to copy the things that, you know, like the design of the iPhone. So what we believe in intangible assets is after the financial crisis, they slowed down rather, and that's contributed to the overall kind of decline in productivity performance that many economies have seen since 2008.
And do you think that that slowdown is a direct result of lenders and statisticians not actually understanding the nature of intangible assets, or because R&D, research and development, is an easy budget to trim because you don't have to lay off so many manufacturing workers?
Yeah, good question. And I think it's mostly the former. As I was saying earlier on, one of the interesting things about intangible assets is they're very hard to measure, and national statistical offices have a lot of difficulty and accountants have a lot of difficulty measuring them, so they're often left out. But as you said, also in your question, Red, it's also the fact that the investors don't really understand intangible assets. And if I may just expand on that for a second, one of the ways, Red, in which they don't understand it is this. If you're a typical startup company and you go to a bank and you say, I want to borrow some money, the bank will say, well, what security have you got? If you have a tangible asset like a house or your car or something like that, you can often pledge that and the bank will give you the money. If you have an intangible asset, an idea for some design, a piece of software, a movie script, a play, a dance, you know, choreography or something like that, banks don't know how to lend against all of that. So once we move into a world which is much more concentrated around people attempting to build those intangible assets, then the banking system comes under pressure because it's essentially designed for a tangible kind of world. And so, again, to go back to your question, what we think is this slow burn by which the economy has increasingly become more orientated towards intangible assets has just increasingly put pressure on an unsuitable financial system. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that now, and the inability of firms to properly finance the intangible assets which they want to invest in.
Productivity is something that we hear again and again and again in the news is one of the aspects of the British economy where we don't measure up against some of our European partners and certainly the Chinese and further afield. The implication is that if there is a stagnation in productivity, that there will have to be a rise in interest rates. Is it that simple?
It's a little more complicated than that, if I may say, but I mean, that's the essence of it. The point about productivity is, we can talk a lot about cakes, since there's lots of discussion in Brexit about having your cake and eating it and all that kind of thing. So let's do the cake analogy if we can. I mean, you can think of productivity as essentially expanding the size of the cake. Okay, so think of the economy 150 years ago with, you know, vast amounts of childhood mortality, nobody went on holiday, people worked, you know, 60 hours a week and all that kind of thing. The much more productive economy we have now is a reflection of is just another way of saying that the cake has got much bigger. So if productivity growth stalls, then the size of the cake stalls. And at that point, economic policy becomes much more difficult to do because there are just trade-offs, which is to say, if somebody wants a bigger slice of a fixed cake, somebody else has got to have less of a slice. If the cake is expanding, then we can give more to some and other people can have more as well. And so in that expanding economy, those types of policy trade-offs become much less important. And that's why the stagnation in productivity is very important for economic policymakers, because they, at that point, they have to face up to these very severe trade-offs.
And that argues also that there would be a growth in inequality between the very rich and the very poor.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And part of that is tied up with the fixed sort of size of the cake and the ability of the rich to get more and the poor to get less. But also part of it is tied up with the kind of character of intangible assets. And one of the economic properties of intangible assets that we talk a little about in the book is the idea of scalability. Once you're Facebook and you've written a clever computer program that links everybody up together, that computer program can be scaled up and it can therefore pull together, you know, the Harvard students upon which Facebook originally started and now, you know, the billions and billions of people, you know, throughout the world. So the scalability of intangible assets means that the people who own those intangible assets, the people who've written the computer program or designed the software or whatever it might be, their ownership is going to become extremely valuable. And that's going to contribute, of course, to tremendous economic fortunes for them and not so much economic fortune for the rest of us.
One thing that I think a lot of us who lived through the dot-com bubble at the turn of the millennium will have come away thinking is that actually intangible assets create a pie crust that when it collapses, the creditors have nothing to take away from the companies that have collapsed. Is that a problem?
I think it is. And I think there's a sense in which the economy might be a bit more bubbly if we have a more intangible asset based economy. As you say, valuations go up, valuations go down, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, what seems like a red hot company can turn out not to be so. Against that, of course, if you think of many enduring companies, I don't know, think of Marks and Spencer, they've been in business for a long time. The asset value of the name Marks and Spencer, the, you know, the brand value of buying the food, the reputation, all that kind of thing is very, very valuable. That may well go down. Some companies go up, some companies go down. But that would be an example, I think, of where you have an intangible asset which probably has quite a sort of safe and enduring value. So I think it's a mix of these things. But on the margin, I think it's probably right that if we have more startups and more intangible assets, there might be a bit more of a sort of bubbly feel to the economy.
And do you see the intangible economy as something that is going to carry on growing inexorably, or do you think it'll hit a plateau at some point in the future?
It's always very dangerous for economists to predict what's going to happen to the future of the economy. One of the things we talk about in the book, which is well known amongst economists, kind of well-known joke amongst economists, who are pretty, you know, a humorless bunch mostly, so it's not that funny a joke, but it is that if you look at predictions in the 1910s for the amount of horse manure that would be in London, you find that it was predicted that, you know, in 1960, London would be submerged, you know, beneath horse manure because people had sort of extrapolated the trend in the number of horses that were around London and had extrapolated that trend and got quite sensibly to that kind of answer. So extrapolating from trends is a kind of difficult thing to do. And we know that in the case of horses, you know, motor cars were invented and so forth. And then all the horses were, you know, quite a modern story in some sense. They were all put out of work by machines, essentially, in that case, motor cars. We think that the trend towards intangible assets will probably endure, partly because I think as economies get richer, the sort of demand for intangible assets goes up, the demand for different goods, the demand for varieties of goods, the demand for new ideas. You know, I've just come from a well-known coffee company, and they've got a new, particularly new brand of coffee that they are offering me with lots of advertisements all over the place and so forth. Again, it's in these very affluent types of economies that we would see more demand for that kind of spread of goods and more demand for types of varieties. So I think as long as the economy keeps growing, the importance of intangible assets will continue.
Now, one of the growth areas has been in digital technology, and that has also seen a growth in the production of audiobooks. And I must confess that 5 years ago, I probably would never have read your book because it would have only been in print, but it has been simultaneously published in audio as well. And it's been rather well read by Derek Perkins. It reads a bit like a thriller in places. You must be delighted that you're reaching a wider audience, some of whom are disabled from reading print, through actually an almost intangible asset.
An entirely intangible asset, Red. I mean, that's right. And hats off to Derek Perkins. I confess I've never met him. And honestly, when we were, you know, very lucky to have some good sales of the book, and the Talking Books people, I think it was the people who turned it into the group of CDs, got in touch with us and asked for the rights. I didn't think that much of it. We were very pleased, obviously, but I didn't think that much of it. But when I listened to Derek Perkins's reading of the book yesterday in particular, just to sort of prepare for this interview, I was absolutely riveted. And, you know, most authors of a book are kind of bored with their book by the time they've done it. But I was absolutely riveted. And he reads it, just as you say, Red, in just a terrific way. I mean, really hats off to him. And I think one of the interesting things is that our book has got some graphs and tables and so forth in it. So it's not a specialist book, I have to say. It's not designed for, you know, deep in the weeds, you know, specialist statistician. And what Derek and the adapters of the book have done is they walk the reader through those tables and graphs in a really imaginative way. So I think that's an additional ingredient of the book, which I find very gratifying.
Well, certainly I never studied economics or statistics beyond O-level maths, and I found it incredibly accessible, and I think I've come away more enlightened in 21st century economics than I could ever have dreamed of being.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's kind to say. We tried as best we could, you know, to write it in a way which communicated, you know, well with an audience. And in a sense, Red, I've never really quite thought about this before. Maybe a test of how well it communicates is precisely how well does it communicate to a blind or partially sighted person, you know, who needs to listen to it because they need to get the rhythm of the sentences. And, you know, it would be, it's not a long book, but, you know, if it's a boring book, you know, a listener would rapidly switch off. But I think, as I say, mostly in the way that Derek Perkins does the intonation of every sentence, which is just tremendously well done. It certainly gripped my interest when he was doing it. So really hats off to him for kind of bringing it all to life.
Well, Jonathan Haskell, thank you so much for opening my eyes to an area of the economy that I had heard about but really didn't understand, and for coming into the RNIB Connect radio studios to tell me all about it.
Thank you, Red. Absolute pleasure to come in.
The dark matter of investment. But, of course, the economy does not run on tangible investment alone. Stansted Airport, for example, owned not just tarmac and terminals and trucks, but also things that were harder to see or touch, complex software, valuable agreements with airlines and retailers, internal know-how. All these things had taken time and money to build up and had a lasting value to whoever owned the airport, but they consisted not of physical stuff, but of ideas, knowledge, and social relations. In the language of economists, they were intangible. The idea that an economy might come to depend on things that were immaterial was an old one. Futurists like Alvin Toffler and Daniel Bell had begun to talk about the post-industrial future as long ago as the 1960s and 1970s. As the power of computers and the internet became more apparent in the 1990s, the idea that immaterial things were economically important became increasingly widely accepted. Sociologists talked of a network society and a post-Fordist economy. Business gurus urged managers to think about how to thrive in a knowledge economy. Economists began to think about how research and development and the ideas that resulted from it might be incorporated into their models of economic growth, an economy parsimoniously encapsulated by the title of Diane Coyle's book, The Weightless World. Authors like Charles Ledbetter suggested we might soon be living on thin air. The bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2000 dampened some of the wilder claims about a new economy, but research continued among economists to understand what exactly was changing. It was in this context that a group of economists assembled in Washington in 2002 at a meeting of the Conference on Research in Income and Wealth to think about how exactly to measure the types of investment that people were making in what they were calling the new economy.
Capitalism Without Capital, The Rise of the Intangible Economy is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, and should be on its way to the RNIB library soon. It's narrated by Derek Perkins. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello there, I'm Jonathan Hackett, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for 15 years. One of my favourite books was Bravo 2-0 by Andy McNab. It's about an SAS team that gets dropped in Iraq to carry out a very dangerous mission during the first Gulf War. And of course this mission goes disastrously and tragically wrong.
Within hours of Iraqi troops and armour rolling across the border with Kuwait at 0200 local time on August the 2nd, 1990, the regiment was preparing itself for desert operations.
It's a very, very exciting book, and it's populated with all sorts of accents. They're a variety. I mean, there's a South African, a Scot, a Brummy, a Cockney, an Aussie. I mean, there's a whole host of them, and it was quite a challenge, particularly around the campfire, so to speak, when they were all contributing to or engaged in a conversation. So it's quite challenging, but a very, very enjoyable book and a very exciting book and a very disturbing book.
There were shouts all along the line. See anything your end yet? Come on, let's get this done!
A second APC with a turret-mounted gun opened fire all along the area. It's not nice to know you're up against armour and vehicles with infantry on board. All you are is a foot patrol, and these anonymous things are crushing relentlessly towards you. You know they carry infantry. You know the driver's in front and the gunner's up top, and he's trying to look through his prism, and it's difficult for him, and he's sweating away up there, getting thrown about, trying to aim. But all you can see is this thing coming screaming towards you, and it looks so anonymous and monster-like, magnified 10 times suddenly because you realise it's aiming at you. They look so impersonal. They leave destruction in their wake. It's you against them. You're an ant, and you're scared. The APC nearest me cracked off more rounds, firing wildly. One burst stitched the ground about 10 metres in front of me. In the British Army, you're taught how to react when the enemy opens fire. You dash to make yourself a hard target. You get down. You crawl into a fire position, find the enemy, set your sights at the range and fire. Reaction to effective enemy fire, it's called. Your instincts compel you to get down and make yourself as small as possible and wait for it all to end. The rational side of your brain is telling you what you should be doing, which is getting up and looking to see what's going on so you can start fighting. There's no point just lying there because you're going to die anyway. The emotional side is saying, sod that, stay there, maybe it'll all go away. But you know it's not going to, and that something has to be done.
I really love the service because of what it provides for blind and partially sighted people. So I love the job as a narrator because of the opportunity to quite literally tell stories. It's great fun, and personally, when you think that it's actually going to help and give enjoyment to other people, then that's the real point of it all.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
It was Rudyard Kipling who coined the phrase, "The female of this species is more deadly than the male." He was writing about Himalayan bears. But my next guest, Trina Beckett, has applied it to the wives of a selection of generals from British history. And, as we'll hear, she credits the completion of her book to RNIB. Trina Beckett, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Can you describe the book for the listeners who might not have read it yet?
Well, it's basically focusing on the wives of famous generals, looking at how they influenced their husbands' careers or not. Because a lot of books, the women just got barely more than a chance in a book of hanging decoratively on their husband's arms. And there's so much more to them than that. And at that time, the times that I've written between 1677 and 1937, the power base was dominated exclusively by the males of the species. But I was just intrigued by this idea that, you know, the success or the lack of might have had something to do with the women, and it certainly did.
And you've come across some amazing characters. I was rather taken by the story of Sarah Churchill, which is very different from the one that we're seeing in the film The Favourite at the moment.
Yes, it is. I mean, I'm quite upset by that, because I feel if people had seen the film and knew nothing about that story, they would believe it. I mean, for instance, just one simple example, there's the rabbits. Rabbits were foodstuffs and pests in those days. They weren't kept as pets for another 100 years, so there were no rabbits in sight.
Sarah Churchill used her influence with Queen Anne to get her husband promoted, didn't she?
She did. In fact, you know, she was so powerful that people, the high-ranking officers and the government officials, would actually turn to her rather than her husband's authority, because she was the one that knew it all and, you know, knew how to deal with it. And he was a very good soldier, no doubt about that. He won some, you know, amazing campaigns, but it was her influence that kept him up there, and particularly, you know, with the princess who then became the queen, because she almost became the queen with her power, to be honest.
And he had quite a spectacular fall from grace as well.
He certainly did. I mean, that again was due to Sarah, because she had a lot of power with the queen, but she pushed it a bit too far. There was one point on the steps of St. Paul's where Sarah publicly told the Queen to be quiet. And that was just about it for Queen Anne. She began to realise, you know, that she was just being pushed too far. And there wasn't this other person, this Abigail, in the film. You know, there's some truth in that. You know, Sarah did introduce her cousin Abigail as an act of kindness, ironically, to be the one in the Queen's bedchamber women. But the Queen took rather a shine to Abigail, who was so much gentler and softer than Sarah, that Sarah was knocked off her post, really. And then, you know, it spread to her husband, because without Sarah's power, he had no power, really. So him and, you know, Godolphin and other people, and that was their demise as well.
You argue, really, that without Sarah's influence, her husband would not have progressed as far, or then fallen as far, as he did.
Undoubtedly. I mean, what she said close to her death, she said, "I am confident I should have been the greatest hero that was ever known in the Parliament House if I'd been so happy as to have been a man." And her lifelong lament was, "Things that are worth naming will ever be done from the influence of men." So, you know, she didn't want to be a man sort of gender-wise, but she just wanted the power they had automatically. So she allied herself to the Queen, got that power, and he, by dint of being her husband, it sort of put him in the limelight as well and gave him chances he would not have had. That's not to say he wasn't a great general, he was, but he got the chances that he would not otherwise had been able to do. That's what the letters and the journals seem to point to.
A couple of the other women whose lives you document were actually pretty active in following their husbands onto the front line.
That's right.
I thought that Florentia Sales, for instance, from the Afghan Wars, was really quite something, wasn't she?
She was incredible. I don't think anyone would have survived without her. I really don't know how she kept going. And she was 54 at the time. And she unwittingly became the first overseas war correspondent because she had kept an hourly journal sort of strapped around her waist. She knew more about the strategies and the things that were going wrong because from her vantage point on a rooftop, sort of literally dodging the bullets behind a chimney. What always amazes me is that her journals got back to England through all that stuff and that correspondents came back. I mean, our post's bad enough in this country without any of that, but somehow it all got through.
And actually, the journal not only got back to England, but was published as a bit of a bestseller.
It was, yes.
Documenting the disasters of the first Afghan war.
Yeah, I mean, nobody else really knew that stuff as intimately as she did, and no one certainly had could be bothered or had the time to write about it, but they became a bestseller in Victorian Britain. But, you know, some people disapproved of what she'd said and thought it was, you know, not correct for her to say those things, but she was just brutally honest. You know, when you look at her journals, it's straight from the heart and truth. She had no need to embellish stuff. It was just as it was, as she saw it happening.
And she was also a prisoner of war for 9 months, I understand.
Well, yes, she was. And when she first knew she was going to Afghanistan, her husband said, well, what would you like to take? She said, well, I'll take some seeds, I'll take my grand piano, and I'll take my most winsome daughter. And she planted those seeds. For the first 6 months, they grew. She grew a kitchen garden. Sadly, she couldn't take her grand piano with her when they went on, you know, on retreat. She was pretty amazing right from the start. You can see what she was like in those early days, really.
She and her daughter both survived as prisoners of war. And did they escape or were they liberated at the end?
Well, they eventually were liberated, but, you know, it wasn't easy. And hundreds of people died, women and children and soldiers. And she felt that some of the strategies that had been employed by the leaders were to blame for all these losses that occurred. So they did eventually get through, but the privation she had to go through, and she hadn't been used to that kind of thing. She was unusual because many of the women hadn't been used to that kind of thing either, but she rose above it. She could even see beauty in the scenery when they were going through. Well, they had everything thrown up. They had stormy, horribly cold winters, weltering hot summers with all the bugs and insects, and an earthquake. And she could still admire the scenery put in her journal.
And another woman who leaps off the page is Juana Smith.
Oh, yes, Juana Smith, yes.
Who I'd come across in the Georgette Heyer novel, Bride.
Yes, yes.
But I'd never realised that the real Lady Smith was even more colourful than Georgette Heyer managed to paint her, really.
Well, this is the thing. You know, fiction misses out the best bits, I feel, sometimes, at the expense of imagining things, which is really sad because there are so many very exciting things about all these women, and fiction often misses out some of the things which, as you say, are just as riveting. And I feel with Sarah Churchill that much of what was in the film, A, it wasn't true, and B, it wasn't as exciting as what wasn't in the film.
Mm. For the audience, could you just detail a little bit about Juana Smith's story?
Yes, well, she was quite highborn. She was Juana Maria de los Dolores de León. For once, I've said it without stuttering. And latterly, Lady Juana Smith, Lady Smith. She was rescued when she was 14 in a siege at Badajoz in Spain. And she and her sister were on the run. And when a siege was won by any army, they had the right to sort of pillage that place, and raping and pillaging, you know, actually happened. But some soldiers didn't do that, and these two officers happened to see the plight of these two young girls, and they rescued them. She was 14 at the time, and Harry Smith married her 2 weeks later, and it was thought that would be, you know, he would never rise any further in the ranks because he'd got this 14-year-old bride in tow. But she soon made herself known, and she just always followed her husband. Duty came first. She was a campaign wife from the age of 14 years until middle age. And she consistently displayed incredible courage and selflessness. She didn't mind privation either, like Florencia Sale. You know, she was highborn, used to the best. But, you know, she slept in mud. She helped others. She was just incredible. And at the end of it all, Lady Smith was named after her and not her husband, because she was the one that people remember.
A rather fitting tribute to a woman who was exceptional in her own time.
Yes. In the reunions now, the veterans of Lady Smith will still drink in silence, they say, to the memory of absent comrades, and spare a thought for that gallant little Spanish girl who soldiered so manfully, from whom the town you fought got its name.
I was quite astounded that nobody has actually done what you've done before. These women, as I say, leap off the page.
They do.
And yet it's taken until 2018, 2019, until somebody has sat down and gathered them all together.
Yes, I was really excited that nobody had done that, because I'm really glad they didn't, because it certainly caught my imagination once I started. I thought, gosh, you know, people don't know this, and it's about time they did. And I chose the span of 200 years because I felt that each woman then would live in a different era with different problems. You wouldn't get, you know, just a lot of women in one era. And it hasn't changed a lot, but there are subtle differences in each time frame of each of the women. So that was another thing that fascinated me as well, you know, that things haven't changed, but they have a little bit, but women were still under the thumb, really. Only a few exceptional ones, you know, rose above it.
The book took 7 years to write, and you went through your own trials and tribulations during that time, and credit the RNIB with actually enabling you to be able to finish the book.
I certainly do, actually. I mean, I'm not blind. My eyes work perfectly well, but they don't work together. So reading, it became a particular difficulty for me. About 7 years ago, not long after I'd started the book, it had always been slightly there, but it got a lot worse. And I needed to have eye surgery, so it was just stopped in its tracks. My book was stopped in its tracks for well over a year. And I'd been warned with my first eye surgery that it may not be 100% successful. And it wasn't, because I then had double vision, which I couldn't do anything. I had to wait 4 months before it was safe for a second operation. For this one, I needed to be woken up halfway through to guide the surgeon with the stitching, so you could see this needle coming towards your eyes. You wouldn't feel anything, but you know what it's like when something comes towards your eyes.
Mm.
That was, but that did put things a lot better. Well, it was another year, really, before I could, it's like it is now. And I still can't read for long periods. But during that time, I went to Truro's branch of the RNIB, and I learned so much. There was Rod Keat, was incredibly helpful. He was the access technology officer. And I came away with so many ideas of how to have the screen. I had voice recognition, which made a huge difference. I didn't have to look from, you know, my notes to my book to the screen, which was really almost impossible for more than about 10 minutes. So it really got me going again. And that, during that time, my eyes were sort of healing. So it's a lot better. But, I mean, I never go to the cinema. I did go to the favourite because I thought I had to. So my husband went with me as my cinema eyes, because things going horizontally back forwards, I just can't do it. So I shut my eyes at most opportunities, but heard it and looked at the bits that were a bit slower. I thought I had to watch that film when it came out. So life is limited, but I have the talking books, which are such a joy. And I actually got to the stage where I prefer listening to books than reading them, because, you know, you can peel potatoes while you're listening to a book.
Deadlier Than the Male, The Wives of the Generals, 1677 to 1937, is out now in print and ebook, and let's hope that an audio version is recorded soon. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.